I'm going to call this meeting to order of the HESS Committee. This is Thursday, February 24th. It is about 7 minutes after 3. And members present, well, first of all, if there's anybody that has a cell phone, if you would please turn it off in the audience. And if any members of the committee need to cough or make any big noise up here, please push your button first, because the transcribers, when we do something like that up here, it blocks out what any testifier is. It blocks out their words entirely. Let the record show that Representative Seaton, Representative Corin, Representative Gardner, and Representative Cisna are present, and myself, Wilson. And my committee HESS aide is Kathy Hope Erickson. Our secretary is Ellen Nodder. And our LIO person is Luke Woodruff. And the order that we're going to conduct things today, we're going to do House Bill 120 first. And this is basically, I'm saying this for people online so you can kind of plan accordingly. House Bill 120, then Senate Bill 42, and then House Bill 69. So having said that, I'm going to turn, because it's my bill, House Bill 120, I'm going to turn it over to the Vice Chairman, Rep Seaton. And then I'll...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we'll be considering House Bill 120. And would you like to present your legislation?
I would.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee members. House Bill 120 is a very simple bill. It actually brings our Alaska standards into compliance with federal standards when we're talking about bloodborne pathogen protection standards. So it's very, very simple. The bill that we have, a couple years ago, the state of Alaska did their standards and passed that into law, and then later at the federal level, they did their standards, and ours are in compliance with them in most everywhere except in two areas. And basically, it's dentist's office and small, like, doctor's offices or maybe some vet's offices, just small offices that are less than 25 people. And at the time, we were thinking that maybe that was an area that it would cost too much for people to do that, and so we were kind of being worried about small businesses, and so that's why they weren't included at the time. But since then, we've learned so much more about bloodborne pathogens and the possibility of not only the patient, but the workers themselves getting AIDS or hepatitis or some type of a blood disease that is passed on by body fluids, that literally all the offices are in compliance with it anyway. And so this is just a way to get our statutes into compliance with it. And right now, not only do we want to be in compliance with the feds, but also there's sometimes there's a little bit of confusion for employees of which standard they need to follow. So we want to just make sure that there's no question about what standard that people need to follow. And also, it also jeopardizes some of our federal grant funds that we could get if we don't have this stuff. So it's kind of like, almost like a housekeeping measure. And having said all that, I think there is somebody online that would like to testify, and I will let them testify.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Does anyone on the committee have a question for the sponsor at this time? Yes, Representative Corin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many medical establishments, Representative Wilson, does this affect?
You know, I really don't know what the numbers are, but it would be, you know, dentist office across the state, doctor's offices, veterinarians, you know, anybody that would give injections or work in the mouth where there's blood available, you know, that they would have access to getting their hands or getting splattered with it or something like that. So it's just... That would be quite a few, really. Mm-hmm. But they already, because of the safety issues to the not only the patient but for the workers themselves, they're already in compliance mm-hmm. with it. So we're not worried whether they're in compliance. We would just like to make sure that our standards match federal standards. Mm-hmm.
And a follow-up question.
Follow-up.
Is there anybody in the medical profession or dentistry that objects to this legislation?
I have heard of no one that objects to this.
And lastly, if they're in compliance...
Representative Corey.
Thank you, sir. If everybody's in compliance, what would be the point in formalizing this in law if things are already, our goal's already being accomplished, other than the risk of losing some federal dollars? Or could that be the main reason?
Well, two. One is the, some grants would not be able to, they would not be able to get them. And then also, the other one is that there are some confusion when people read one set of standards and then read another set, and they're different. And so we just want to bring them all up so that they're the same.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The sponsor statement that we have before us says that this bill is removing two exemptions, repealing two exemptions, one referring to intraoral procedures and the other for healthcare organizations with fewer than 25 full-time employees. I don't see the reference to intraoral procedures, or is that, I mean, in the bill itself, I just see the part about 25. Am I misreading it, or?
I think it's that statute, Section 2. Let's see. If you go to the sectional analysis, that's Section 2, and that repeals, that exempts employers with fewer than 25 full-time employees.
I see. Thank you.
Is there anyone else that has a question for the sponsor? Okay, we have two people online. Thank you, Representative Wilson. Camille Soleil, are you in Anchorage?
Yes, sir, I am.
Yeah, would you identify yourself and who you're representing, and then go ahead with your testimony, please?
Yes. My name again, Camille Soleil. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Nurses Association. We just wanted to let you know that the Alaska Nurses Association does support House Bill 120 because of the clarification. The standards laid out in the statute with the clarification of this bill provide clear and consistent protection for both patients and for healthcare workers alike. We realize it's just a cleanup bill, but we think it makes a lot of sense for communicating the safety.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone on the committee have a question? Okay, thank you again for your testimony. And now we'll go to Gary Mitchell. Are you online?
No, I'm here.
Oh, you're here. Could you come forward, please?
It's actually Gray Mitchell, and I'm the director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And one of the programs that I'm in charge of is the Occupational Safety and Health Program for Alaska. This program operates under a special jurisdiction from the federal government, where, based on the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, states could apply for and receive a special jurisdiction to cover occupational safety and health within their states. The catch is that when a state does apply for that, they have to agree to maintain standards that are at least as effective as federal standards. And as the Madam Chair, Representative Wilson pointed out, this is an area where the state created some standards because there weren't any standards on the books at the time at the federal level. The following year, the federal OSHA came out with a big broad set of bloodborne pathogen protection standards. And so from that point forward, federal OSHA has been kind of on our backs to get this issue straightened up so that we don't have a situation where the state requirements are less strict than the federal guidelines. And the administration strongly supports the bill, and we thank Representative Wilson for introducing it. And if you have any questions, let me know.
I guess I had one question that Representative Gardner touched on. So this isn't removing dentists, basically, or oral professionals from these procedures. This is actually putting them under these procedures, because there was an exemption for them before, and now that this removes that exemption so that oral dentists will be covered under this bill.
That's correct. And it's a little bit confusing because the federal standards were adopted actually under a separate statute. So, you know, we've got a statute that allows us to adopt federal regulations in 1860.020, and we've adopted the federal guidelines on bloodborne pathogens, but at the same time, we've got a state law that is conflicting with those federal standards that we've adopted. The dentists are all complying with the federal standards. You know, the liabilities associated with, you know, not making sure you're using the protective devices that are available, and, you know, it's just common sense stuff. You know, you put the needle in a box that the needle can't poke out of, you know, and get somebody. So they're all complying is basically the guidance that we've received from the Dental Society on this issue already. And so it's not really expected to be a major impact on them, and it really clears up some confusion that has been on the books for a couple of years.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Cisna?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just a question, just for curiosity's sake. I know that this should have real implications where something like HIV were involved, and because we're the air crossroads of the world, right here in our airports, what other bloodborne pathogens might be involved? Do you know?
Well, some of the big heavy hitters in Alaska are hepatitis.
Okay.
You know, some of the other diseases that are sexually transmitted diseases are some of the big ones that you know, Alaska has higher than you know, per capita rates than other states. But hepatitis is really one of the biggest ones that you know, affects Alaskans. And, you know, with these healthcare businesses where they're dealing with, you know, blood and needles and, you know, cutting instruments and things like that that may have been contaminated, again, it just makes sense to make sure that the protections are in place. And that's why, you know, it is really kind of more of a house cleaning bill that you know, maintains the Alaska program, which in our conversations with the Dental Society, that was one of their concerns, is that they wanted to make sure that the Alaska Occupational Safety and Health maintained jurisdiction in Alaska. Because if the feds were to come in and take over, you know, right now you can get a hearing in front of a group of people who are Alaskans in Alaska on an issue that you might dispute. If federal OSHA was to take over, you'd have to go down to Seattle or San Francisco to, you know, have a hearing on an issue that you disputed. So, you know, there's a lot of support behind keeping the program in Alaska.
Thank you.
Does anyone else on the committee have a question for? Thank you very much. And is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on House Bill 120? Do we have anyone else online? I'd like to close the public hearing, and we'll be in committee discussion. I would note for the committee that we have 2-0 fiscal notes, one for labor and workforce development and the other one for public health. Is there any discussion on House Bill 120?
Ready for a motion?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass out of a committee House Bill 120 with individual recommendations and accompanying 2-0 fiscal notes.
Very good. Do I see any objections? No objections. The bill will move.
Is there a third? Is that one?
No, that's House Bill 130.
Thank you.
And so House Bill 120 will move from committee with the test, with two test fiscal notes and individual recommendations. And Madam Chair, I'll pass you back together.
Thank you. Okay, next on our agenda is Senate Bill 42, and that is the Naturopathic Medicine Task Force, and that is Senator Ralph Siegman's bill, and his aide, Joe Michelle, is here to present the bill. So, Joe, go ahead and explain the bill to us.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Joe Michelle. I'm a legislative aide to Senator Ralph Seekins. The bill I'm presenting today is SB 42, which extends the reporting date for the termination and the report for the on the task force of the naturopathic task force. SB 42 is an extension of SB 306, which was a product of the 23rd Alaska Legislature. SB 306, which passed 35-5 in the House and unanimously in the Senate, established a task force to study the scope of practice of naturopathic medicine. By statute, the task force was charged with addressing the following six things: the comparable level of education and training of naturopaths and medical doctors, the appropriate scope of practice relating to the use of legend or prescription drugs by naturopaths, the appropriate scope of practice for non-pharmacological treatments by naturopaths, including minor surgeries, the structure and operations of collaborative protocols and agreements, issues relating to joint liability between collaborating practitioners, and any other issues determined to be relevant by the members of the naturopathic task force. The task force was to have 9 members. It does. We've met 4 times so far this since the task force has been formed. It was to be comprised of 1 Alaska State Senator, 1 Alaska State Representative, a member of the Alaska State Medical Association, a member of the Alaska Pharmacist Association, a member of the Alaska State Medical Board, a member representing nurse practitioners, an employee of the Department of Community and Economic Development, Division of Occupational Licensing, and 2 members who are licensed to practice naturopathic medicine in the state of Alaska. The task force was unable to complete its business within the time parameters specified in SB 306. Consequently, SB 42 extends the task force's charge into 2005. In fact, SB 42 is identical to the previous bill, SB 306, except for the report and termination dates have been changed to December 1st, 2005 and February 1st, 2006, respectively. You can find that on page 2 of the bill. To the chair, if there's any questions from the committee, I'm here to answer them. Otherwise, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have 2 questions. They're not related. One of them is on page 1, line 11. Can you define the meaning of the word legend in this context?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. No, I can't. It has to do just with prescription drugs and the different levels of prescription drugs that are allowed. I couldn't give you an official range of it, but anywhere from, you know, the strongest, rarely prescribed medicine down to something that a doctor would feel comfortable having your mother prescribe you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's different levels, and that's what they're discussing.
Do you know how legend, excuse me, it follows, how legend differs in meaning from the prescription drugs?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, no, I don't. I'd be happy to get that information for you.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that. And then my other question is...
Follow-up.
Thank you. Actually, this is my other question, not follow-up, but you said the committee has met 4 times. Is that just that it's so difficult because of the members of the committee finding time 4 times in a year? Is all that could be arranged?
Through the chair, we didn't. The task force was not officially formed, as far as names being accepted, until late November, early December of last year.
Oh my!
Due to just, I mean, that time of election season and things of that nature, mm-hmm. that it just wasn't formed. They met once before the new year. And since then, 3 times down here in Juneau via teleconference.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone online that would like to testify? I guess we have 1. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay. We have 1 person online, Wayne Adderhold from Homer. Wayne, state your name and your affiliation.
It's Wayne Adderhold. I'm representing myself, 350 Grubstake and Homer. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I urge you to pass this bill and extend the life of the Naturopathic Task Force for the benefit of your constituents. The naturopath recently submitted a very reasonable proposal for dealing with prescriptive rights, and Senator Seekins is facilitating careful and complete examination of all pertinent issues. I and a growing number of Alaskans rely on naturopathic physicians for a large and increasing portion of my health care because they clearly adhere to the foundation of medicine, quote, first do no harm. So there is a lot at stake for Alaskan consumers on the outcome of this task force and the resulting legislation. I can document a number of incidences over the past few years where the provisions of the proposed changes and privileges for naturopathic physicians would have benefited me directly, both from a health care and an economic standpoint. Please do not lose sight of the fact that this is largely a consumer issue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And next we have, thank you very much, because we've got two people here that I'm going to call up. Dean George with Plunkett Haida. I'm sorry. You're right. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on this bill? Okay, if not, then we will close public testimony. And do I hear anything from any of the members here? Representative Seaton.
Yes, Madam Chair, I listened in on the teleconference, the first one, which was in December, and, you know, we could tell that although it was doing the job that we asked them to do last year, it was just very late getting organized and couldn't meet the timelines. And so, I definitely support extending these timelines for this cooperative work within the both all the medical and naturopathic community to go forward.
And I also thank you, Representative. I've also kind of kept up with some of the people that are some of the members of the task force, and they definitely need more time. And for all of your, for anybody that's listening, we do have a fiscal note, but it's a zero fiscal note from Commerce. So. Representative Cisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I recall, I was on, I think we had a subcommittee, if I'm not mistaken, on this bill, and I remember hearing early on the discussions about just how necessary a task force was because of just all the sort of in-depth questions
right.
that needed to be answered, and so it sounds like it ought to be given a chance.
Yeah. I think so, too. So do I hear a motion? Representative Seaton.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 42 with zero fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee.
Okay. Hearing no objection, so moved. So congratulations. Okay. That brings us back to our last bill, House Bill 69. And House Bill 69 is the Director of the Division of Public Assistance with us, Catherine Farnham, and she's to present the bill and to answer questions for the committee. So, Catherine.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to visit with the committee again. Again, my name is Catherine Farnham, and I'm the Director of the Division of Public Assistance, and I'm here to encourage your support for House Bill 69, and this is for the Native Family Assistance Program. I was able to review a little bit about this program and this particular bill early in the session, so I don't want to repeat everything, but I will hit some of the highlights. Essentially, that the Native Family Assistance Program is a state match or a state complement to tribal temporary assistance programs. Federal law has allowed since 1996 tribal programs to get direct federal block grants for public assistance. And for those programs to be fair and equitable in the same way the state would have served them, a state supplement in the form of the Native Family Assistance Program grants has been offered. In the legislature in 2000, the legislature chose to go ahead and pass this program, however, to put a sunset on it for June of 2005 this year, to request that a report be written to evaluate how successful the program may have been, and also to limit it to only four of the 13 federally authorized entities. 13 entities were authorized by the Federal Welfare Reform Act, and those were the 12 Native regional nonprofits and Metlakatla. In the bill passed in 2000, that was restricted to Tanana Chiefs Conference, Association of Village Council Presidents, Tlingit and Haida, and Metlakatla. And of those four, three of them have been operating a tribal TANF, is what we refer to it as, operating a tribal TANF program since 99, 2000, or 2001, depending on when they started up. And the report, which the legislature was received earlier, does include the explanations on the nature of the project, the way that they have been able to take those federal and state programs and be very successful. The whole emphasis on all of these temporary assistance programs is put people to work, people moving from public assistance to self-sufficiency. So we're pleased with the results of those pilot years, and we'd like to see the bill made permanent rather than temporary and sunsetting. And the other thing that this bill does is it expands it to the full 13, therefore matching the federal authorities. It's not that all 13 are going to immediately come on board and ask or seek to run a tribal TANF program. However, there are a few in the wings waiting in support of this expansion and this making it permanent so that they can begin to do some of the same things that the three have. And those that are in the wings include Cook Inlet Tribal Council. We've been working with them. We, the department and the Division of Public Assistance, has been working with Cook Inlet for about 9 months in preparation for them running a tribal TANF program in the Anchorage area for all Alaska Natives and American Indians in the Anchorage area. And that would be a significant new tribal TANF partner, and it's one of the nation's largest in a way, because we all know Anchorage is the state's largest Native village now, and takes a little over 700 cases from the state of Alaska and puts them with Cook Inlet. This is not completely new to Cook Inlet, though. They have been a contractor for the state on the case management aspects of this work for a number of years and been highly successful. The fiscal note attached to this bill pertains to the Cook Inlet addition. The rest of the budget is already in the fiscal year 06 governor's budget, which would assume continuation for the three existing programs. So the fiscal note really points to the fact that Cook Inlet is gearing up and quite ready to start on July 1. Sometime later in 06, we anticipate discussions with two other smaller Native regional organizations, because they've expressed their interest formally with the federal government and ourselves. And those two are Bristol Bay Native Association and Manilik. The two of those together are relatively small, so they're not that significant. And at this point, too early in the planning stages to know when and if that'll ever take effect as compared to Cook Inlet. So that's a quick summary, and I do say quick because I've been here before and I don't want to repeat things you've heard. I'll be happy to take questions.
Representative Seeg?
Yes, on fiscal note three, it's showing a general fund match of $3,685,000. And what I thought I heard was this was pass-through money. Is this, of the $4,093 total, is most of this state GF match, or am I?
Correct. When the TANF program for these residents is run as a state program, we have a maintenance of effort, which is general fund match. When it becomes a tribal program, and we can, again, to be provide a fair and equitable program, give them some state monies, we can also count that as maintenance of effort for the statewide program. So it was general fund when we were running into the state program, and yes, the Native Family Assistance Program is funded by general fund, and it does count as our maintenance of effort. That answers your question.
So we're really just moving the money from one place to another?
The general fund portion is definitely just being moved from our temporary assistance component to our Native Family Assistance component. And you'll sort of see that there's a summary on the bottom of all four fiscal notes, because there are four, and someone would ask, I asked, what's the big picture? And it's outlined in the bottom table where you can see the tribal assistance total of $4,093,000. And it's got two components, a general fund and an interagency piece. That's a net addition in tribal assistance, but that's also a reduction in the line item above ATAP. There's other ATAP reductions, so that's, but they're inside there. That the amount of general fund that used to go to ATAP for Cook Inlet families now goes to Cook Inlet.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I understand that you're very supportive of this and happy with the results that the TANF program has brought thus far to the three participating groups. Do you see any downside to this at all?
I think the thing that we learned in the review of the three programs and that we need to maintain an eye for is the capacity of the organizations to take on all the responsibilities associated with a tribal TANF program. The one area where we did observe and the organizations themselves acknowledged they had challenges pertained to the complexity of the IT systems and the federal reporting. And some of these organizations did not have a state IT department to help them produce perfect reports. So the state helped in some early years with some funds for IT systems. However, the lessons learned now tell us perhaps a better solution is to allow them to utilize the state system. And in fact, the Cook Inlet Tribal Council implementation is designed with that in mind, where they actually utilize our technology. They don't have to the expense of building a new one or purchasing a new one, and it works. And we're developing arrangements to share that system. That would be the main thing I'd keep an eye out for.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You know, that is very important because those records are used in other areas of state government.
Yes.
And I found that out when I had someone that wanted a record of some of the transfers of money in the child support case. Right. And it wasn't available, and that was the reason. So I think that's really important because down the line it really makes a difference when you have to have a paper trail for something and you don't. So that's extremely important.
Absolutely, and it has been a finding, and some of the other existing grantees, specifically Tananaw Chiefs, are interested in perhaps moving away from their own system to follow the Cook Inlet approach after we demonstrate that that works.
Okay. Representative Sisner?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Gardner's question. I would also ask, I'm assuming that new workers that come to the department would have exactly the same problem, right? And that there is training to get people prepared for filling out that form, no matter who it is, even if maybe they have master's level training, but they haven't actually dealt with this particular issue before, they would require training. So it would be, to what extent is that built in working with groups like this? Because that it saves, this does save the state money, and it does make it local, which means that it actually can be more flexible and reflect the community. So to what extent does training fit into being shared besides just the technology?
Representative Sisna, through the chair, that's actually an important part of our transition planning with Cook Inlet, and it was done with the other three. Especially at startup, the complexities of eligibility determination are significant, and we've got a fairly robust training program and training team in the Division of Public Assistance because we have hundreds of staff who need to know intricate details about eligibility and get it right. So we are making our training resources available to the new startups, Cook Inlet Tribal Council. We actually have them as a member of the planning and implementation team, and we'll be running some dedicated training sessions for Cook Inlet Tribal Council staff. The goal with Cook Inlet will be similar to what's been achieved in many ways with the other three, and that is eventually they build their own capacity as well. And on an ongoing basis, as they have a new employee start up, they can do mentoring and development with knowledgeable staff. However, we do anticipate ongoing need to stay in touch because there may be policy changes in the future, especially as temporary assistance for needy families approaches federal reauthorization. There will be changes, And the state certainly is got a deeper resource for being able to modify training and take those new modules out to staff. We have an agreement to share policy change related training with the tribal partners as well.
Good. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
I have one, Chair.
Representative Coring has a question.
All right, here we go.
Oh, and you know what? Before we get started, I'd like to note for the record that Representative Anderson joined us at 3:30. So.
So we're talking general fund monies here, ma'am.
Excuse me.
We're talking general fund monies helping to support the program. Then is that what I'm reading here in the fiscal note?
Representative Corn, through the chair, yes, the program has a maintenance of effort at a statewide level at 75%, and that's true of both the state programs and then also this is for the tribal programs.
Do I read this as $5.7 million a year? Do I read that fiscal note right, as far as the general fund match?
That's not, Representative Corn, through the chair, the $5.7 million that I see in the fiscal note, the summary table, is a reduction to general funds, which...
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't pay attention to the parentheses there.
Right.
Can you explain that, though, nevertheless?
Certainly. The $5.7 million is a reduction. On, again, fiscal note 3, it shows that the reduction to general fund comes in two pieces. The first piece is, as I said, merely a transfer from our ATAP component over to our tribal assistance. That's a transfer of 3.685. However, because the federal block grant of the states does shrink, so too does our maintenance of effort floor. So the federal block grant that moves to Cook Inlet reduces the state's block grant and allows us to lower our maintenance of effort floor, and that's the $2,070,000 reduction. I'm on page 2 of fiscal note 3. So two general fund reductions there of this component, one of which is a true reduction, the other is a transfer that you'll see on the table below, resulting in a net fiscal impact, should Cook Inlet come on board, of a $2 million general fund reduction.
Madam Chair, if I may continue, what is being done to discourage people from going on welfare, and what are you doing to encourage those that are on welfare to get off it?
Representative Coring, through the chair, I'll start with the people who are on welfare and what we're doing to help them move off. The entire program is focused on work first, and we focus on employment from the moment a client comes to us. In fact, we even have a diversion program wherein somebody does not even get started on temporary assistance, but we look at some immediate short-term needs that a family might need before they actually become a regular client of temporary assistance. The programs, once they might be registered as a public assistant recipient or temporary assistant recipient, could include job search. It could include some subsidized employment with an employer. It may include work readiness training. We've got Job Club, and we are continuing to strengthen our job center partnerships to ensure our public assistance families and adult workers are really going out and seeking jobs. As preventative measures, we're looking more at that, and we're able to take some of the money that is saved from what used to pay for cash assistance and reinvesting that in areas, for example, trying to prevent substance abuse or trying to ensure out-of-wedlock pregnancies are prevented. We're trying to ensure that youth are able to actually look forward to having a completed education. So our funds are invested into the kinds of preventative measures that enable people, low-income families, to avoid public assistance in the first place with work readiness-related activities.
And one final thing. What's the point in having the program enshrined in law and making it permanent as opposed to just putting another sunset date on it? Then we can reevaluate the effectiveness of the program 5 years down the road or whatever we decide to do. Why enshrine it?
Representative Coring, through the chair, I think that it would be wise to go ahead and put a permanent statute comparable to the federal statute. Federal statute is permanent. It's going to allow the tribe and the state to continue to receive the temporary assistance federal block grants. And I think that the uncertainty associated with the state match does create some unease perhaps for the organizations that say, we'll take it on, but wait, what if we only got half the money? And we have not contemplated exactly what might happen if the state program ended, whereas the federal program continued for the tribal organizations. However, they would obviously see a reduction in their available resources and potentially return those programs back to the state to run.
I just think it ought to be in the hands of the legislature, and there ought to be a continued sunset date on the program so we can evaluate down the road as to whether the program is doing its job.
I can't remember the facts that you gave us last time, but if I remember right, all across of all the states across the United States that have this program and that are trying to ratchet down the amount of people that are going to work that are on the program, Representative Coring, what's happened across the states, all of the states have gotten to a plateau of the people that they, or maybe not all of them, but the majority of them,
many,
have gotten to a plateau where they've gotten as many people off as they can to go to work, and so now they're at a plateau, but Alaska is still seeing that transition taking place. So I think Alaska can be pretty good, feel pretty good about where we're at in that program right now, because we're still seeing a ratcheting down, and so we're still making progress. So that's kind of exciting.
And Madam Chair, if I may add to that, one of the reasons I think Alaska is being successful at continuing to reduce the caseloads is partly because of the strong community-based programs that the tribal organizations can offer. Their programs, when combined with other parts of their tribal programs in their regions, have even greater flexibility than the state does. And in sort of comparable years, there seem some better results in some parts of the state because of that. We are doing well as a state. We've got our third year of high-performance bonus for continuing to move families off. We do, though, continuously wonder at what point are we dealing with the hardest to serve families. And in fact, we're having to take some of these programs, as are the tribes, and create strategies that serve more complicated families, families with multiple issues, not just I don't have the job or I don't have the skills. The idea is that at any point in most societies, there's some population, maybe they're just entering the need or they are passing through. It's smaller in our state. It's still shrinking. But the anticipated need at the federal level, and I would say at the state level, is that a public assistance program is a viable need on an ongoing basis. And making this permanent allows the tribes to understand the stability of their funding in the same way that the state can.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I understand the spirit of Representative Coring's question and concern because I have it too. I'll support the legislation to move out of the committee. But, you know, I read with interest the governor's transmittal letter, and, you know, the committee doesn't have to follow along. I'll just quote it where he states that this is supplemented by state grant funds, which is what Representative Coring was asking about, and Governor Murkowski says that would otherwise be spent. In other words, if we don't pass the bill to serve the same number of Alaska Native families receiving assistance from the state's temporary assistance program. So he's saying, hey, pass the bill, let's have the federal and the nonprofit partnership. But still, there's that philosophical view, and as policymakers, I concur with Representative Coring, because of probably an urban and rural divide and maybe philosophical differences and the perception, whether true or not, but probably a little bit true, just even if I don't have the numbers in front of me, that there is not as many incentives to work for many of the recipients, and you know that translates to borough organization bills and things like that where there's such a rejection, and then we look at unemployment statistics and it's perceived to get higher and there's not a lot of resolution. And I think the bill is important, though, in terms of funding, and I think your responses were fair, but, and I hate to get into parties, but as Republicans, and I'm probably not as good as a student to Representative Coring as I should be at being a fiscal conservative at times, that's something critical as, you know, finances wane, and you know this too, I don't think you disagree, and we're looking at where do we spend excess monies, and where are the incentives for jobs, and I think you answered that, but it just, I think it's a fair question, because it's like, okay, the macro perception is, okay, another welfare program, and I know that's not exactly what it is, but, and it's like, and this is a lot of money, and the governor says, hey, wait a minute, pass the bill or we'll have to give the money in a different venue and different channel anyway, And we think more on the foundational level, which is, you know, why can't we reduce this in half or more, regardless of ethnicity or federal mandates or owing and all this stuff. I mean, we're Caucasian. You get into larger problems problematically with that, and I'll support the bill. But I'm glad that at least you recognize that as legislators, it's good to supplement these with, hey, these are the success stories. Mm-hmm. And as new, or one of you said, as new people come in, others come out and get jobs, and then we have younger folks that are unemployed. And those are good things to know as you give your presentation to finance, and then they supplement it on the floor. So thanks.
Thank you. Representative Corn, did you have an amendment that you wanted?
I don't think so. I just wanted to note my overall concerns about the legislation, the fact that it's another social program. It's not a native versus non-native issue in my mind. It's just more welfare, more government subsidies, more taxpayer subsidies, and I would like to see us move in the direction of, and I don't object to trying to help people and trying to get them on their feet, help them to find gainful employment. That's all good. But maybe a way to satisfy my concern would be to change the law that would require some sort of a repayment provision for services received by the state if they achieve a gainful employment and they're out there succeeding in life and they're making some money to reimburse the taxpayer, basically. Have you thought of something like that?
Representative Corrine, through the chair, this is a federal program, so no, I haven't, and I don't believe that's been considered at the federal level either in terms of a repayment program. There are provisions within the complex funding streams here that, for example, child support, as collected, comes back and repays the state for the costs that we may have paid to a family during the years it paid public assistance. So that's one of the functions of the child support collection. And I'd like to also underscore that while maybe a simple look at it would say another welfare program, this is actually less money than what we're spending this year. And with each one of these community-run programs, we're actually going to save state dollars. So it's a more efficient approach to providing a necessary service while all the time we're putting people into self-sufficient jobs, we're able to take the savings and make sure future families don't end up on welfare.
Representative Seaton first, then you're next.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that, you know, one of the also goals is to move into the private sector where we can provision of services instead of having a whole more state employees. And this is one aspect that does accomplish our goal of partnering with and having the private sector, in this case the tribal entities, actually do those services instead of having to hire more state employees. So I understand fully the reasoning behind trying to reduce, but this is one way that we do reduce and we keep the number of state workers at a minimum.
I think you just found the guy who will present the bill on the floor.
Representative Gardner, or is it Representative Sitna?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Sort of to this continuing discussion, as I recall, this is really the first time that we've really jumped into allowing local groups to actually administer some of these programs. Am I correct? And in that, it essentially says that we've been working at this problem for a long, long time. We finally have moved in a direction which it's not so much privatizing as it's putting it right down where you can really find solutions, right where you can really have economies, because you're really dealing with the sources of the problems and dealing with those, because local people know those things. People in the state government don't. And I think we ought to be celebrating this big time. Thank you.
Well, Representative Sisna, through the chair, you're correct that the tribal organizations are the first ones to take on the full scale of temporary assistance, from eligibility to case management to employment and retention services. And they are working well because, and I can't hardly say it better, the people in the local areas know their people, their economy, their employers better than we do. I'm proud of the success of the Division of Public Assistance. We're part of the group that's brought this caseloads down. However, we're very excited about engaging these regional organizations. And a footnote, it is not just about Native organizations. The example in the YK Delta, where Association of Village Council Presidents has a tribal TANF program, they run the entire TANF program for the region. The state is not out there alongside them replicating or duplicating. So they are serving both Natives and non-Natives alike. And should we proceed with Bristol Bay, it may very well be the same way, because they have a much stronger presence in that region, and some of those tribal organizations are successfully serving the region, not just their shareholders. Thank you for the opportunity to add those points.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have someone on line. Don Schursel in Fairbanks. Don, are you online? Is Fairbanks online? Okay. They probably got tired of us talking. Well, then we'll come back to them if they come back a little bit later then. We do have some people here in the audience, and Dean George with Tlingit Haida. Now, we've got the right bill now.
Good afternoon. My name is Dean George. I am the TANF coordinator for the Tlingit Haida Central Council, and I'm here, representing the Central Council. And I do have a packet that was passed out, which is our written testimony from our employment and training director, Sharon Olson. And at this time, I think I'd probably go ahead and either rely on that, as you can read yourself, or I can certainly read that into testimony, into record, or I can sit here and answer any questions that you may have with regard to a local program.
Representative Sisna?
I'd love to hear, and thank you, by the way, Madam Chair, I'd love to hear from you kind of why you think that doing this locally, by you dealing with finding work for your people and solving the problems that exist here, why that's a good thing compared to the state doing it.
Well, thank you. One of the things that I've seen in the past several years as the coordinator for the Tlingit Haida program is just that, the success of getting out there and having a local presence, a face that is familiar to residents of the communities that we serve. And it's almost a personal one-on-one contact with them. And what that has certainly done is brought those individuals that may not have utilized the state services before are now coming to the tribe to get those services that they do need.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Just a compliment. Thank you for your packet and for taking the time to come testify. And this is a great example of, and I think you've also brought some of that information for us to be able to see the dynamics of food, daycare and work, and this is what I like. And then that yields more support because then you see it tangibly in numbers. So thanks for that.
Manager. Representative Gardner.
I concur with the comments preceding mine, and I noticed that the total number of people served drops pretty consistently from one month to the next, except that in from June to July, it increases slightly, and maybe it's not a statistically significant increase. And then again, in, from November to December, it increases a little bit. I'm sort of surprised by the June to July increase, because I would think that maybe there's more work available during the summer months. Do you have any idea why that is?
Which?
In June of 03, you had 117 people on assistance, and then it went up to 128 in July. I mean, are there people coming into the community maybe who weren't there in May and June, or? Because other than that one month, it just goes down every month a little bit, or close to that.
You might be able to get back with us on that. It is most people because of different jobs and availability to get out and do things more in the summertime. We usually see it. It's usually opposite that. So
I guess probably to give you some clarification on the graphs that I hear. These are all, or well, not all. Several of them have been combined since we didn't have reportable statistics on the number of different reporting elements that we had, you know, to our federal grantor, and it which is our work participation. And so a lot of those were combined, well, not a lot, but some of them were combined into one category there. So I'd have to go back and take a look and find out.
That's okay. Thank you. Representative Sisna.
Madam Chair, just having been self-employed for 28 years, I can tell you that I was always slow in the summer. and it was the winter when my business was just hopping. So I can say that it's hard to know until you know and you have the person that actually was keeping those records. What jobs are available? Because sometimes all the jobs have been taken up and there isn't any. You know, the work isn't there.
Well, thank you. I think the other thing, too, certainly is going back to having that familiar face and the people that are coming to. This might be one of those peaks where some people really, you know, looked at the tribal TANF program and said, well, do you know, I believe I can get either service or get the service I need and have come maybe just at that time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Molly Merritt, Doreen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Molly Merritt Duren, and I'm the Director of Employment and Training Services at Cook Inlet Tribal Council. Thank you for allowing me to be here today to speak in support of House Bill 69. Just a little information on Cook Inlet Tribal Council. We're sort of home away from home for all Alaska Natives and American Indians that live in the Anchorage area and our eight surrounding villages in the Siri region. We currently have programs that include employment and training, substance abuse services, family services, youth employment in school and out of school youth programs. And we intend to, if approved, move our tribal TANF program into our employment and training services because we're very much focused on the potential of our people. And we think employment is the key. Some of the things that would probably be of interest to you, and I know you're tired and it's been a long day, so I'll be brief, is that we have been doing TANF case management for 8 years as a state vendor. So we have a lot of experience. And just to give you a little statistics, basically when you negotiate with the federal government and then the state government, you go back to the 1994 caseload. And the 1994 caseload in the Anchorage area was 1,123. currently, and this is for Alaska Native American Indians, currently, as of November of 2004, that was 692. Whoa. So basically, during that same period, Alaska Natives and American Indians on the 1990 census were listed as 12,000. On the 2000 census, if you count Alaska Native American Indians and others, those that list as Alaska Native American Indian and a mixed race, that's at 46,000. So during that time period, while we did case management for the state, we brought that caseload down by 62% with a huge influx. So I just want to speak to that as far as our capacity. In addition, Cook Inlet Tribal Council provides IT services and accounting services for 39 nonprofit agencies through the 4-Acre Group with United Way. So we have the infrastructure. We have the experience. Other things that you might be interested in regard to comparability and accountability, is that we're still, as a vendor for the state, or whether we become a tribal TANF provider, we're still held to the 5-year limit for people to be on services. So there is no that's equity across the board. So it's a big responsibility to take on a program like this. But we think we're poised, we're ready, we're experienced. And I have other information if you have questions for me.
I have a question. When you first started 8 years ago doing this, did you find that because you were closer to your population that when you took it over for the state that there probably was a rise in the numbers to begin with, and then you helped them and got them going, and then that you saw a difference? Because I'm trying to think of what we need to anticipate with these other programs. That is there a slight rise to begin with, and then it goes down? What do we have to expect?
I'm going to give you a couple of examples. I would say, from what I've heard on a national level, that there is usually an increase because there are people who maybe were not comfortable that do come, and we are home away from home. Another example that's I'd like to give is, at one point we used another friend vendor in Anchorage, Nine Star Enterprises, for GED services. And when we sent our participants down there, we weren't having the success that we anticipated. So we talked to Nine Star and we said, you know, if you would put your instructors on site, let's just try that. We're having tremendous success because it's in a comfortable environment. The word of mouth gets out and people come. So I do think we can have more success because we can wrap around services a little easier than the state because we're not a silo funding source. We can, through our board of directors and public law 477, we can put our funds where we can do system wraparound services, and we do. So that makes it a little more flexible. Other issues are the fact that we are well aware that some of the life skills transitioning from rural to urban are need to be addressed. Also, substance abuse issues. Under the state and some of the federal state guidelines, you can't do that as easily as you can with the tribal TANF. We think we can really get to more of the core issues and move people through the system by having the flexibility of tribal TANF. And that results in a savings for the state.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Representative Sisler?
And thank you, Madam Chair. That is really fascinating in terms of the whole accountability and building models that can be retained over time. And that's one of my huge concerns, is that so often we have programs that come and go. The funding comes and goes, and it's really hard to track success when all of the personnel have come and gone because new administrations, new ideas, and run through a stable organization that is really a local-based organization, and as you say, wrapping around and having the whole person served rather than, and have you thought in terms of doing some of the some assessments of using those multiple multiple approaches in one program for long-term effectiveness, so that for us there is a record of a model that works that can be replicated elsewhere in the state? Have you thought in terms of that?
Representative Sisman, through the chair, I think that's a delightful idea, and I would certainly entertain doing that for you if you'd like. Within our my department, we have tribal vocational rehabilitation. We have all kind of employment and training services, child care as it relates to work, and of course the case management, which we hope to expand to the full tribal TANF. So I think we could be a good model to do that. We have developed a central intake process with our partners at the state. When we become tribal TANF, they are also going to put on site food stamp and Medicaid eligibility, where we do one intake with all the eligibility people and the case manager, where it's a team approach. And I think it'll be very successful with our interface of our IT system with the state's eligibility information system. I think we'll be able to make sure that no funds get lost, because it calculates and formulates no matter whether it's food stamps, Medicaid, tribal TANF, and we could be very responsive in that way. If you would like to entertain, we do that for you.
Great. Yeah, and that would be great. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, whether or not this becomes part of this, and it's rather hard to have that happen when you're talking about many different kinds of programs, some of which couldn't meet that. I can tell you that I would like to meet with you and make positive that that we make it that information available to the legislature, so that we can hold on to Alaskan-built models. That's what we have to do.
I think that would be something that the whole committee would be interested in, and not that we want you to run out and work real hard to get that, but it be obviously you guys have actually, you know what works with, you know, with your population, and we all need help in learning what works and what doesn't work. So I think it would be very good for us to see.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to work with you as to find out exactly what you'd like, and would be more than happy to provide it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I don't see any more questions. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? And we did get Fairbanks back online. Okay, Don Schursel, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, state your name and your affiliation, and let us hear what you have to say.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Don Schursel. For the past 21 years, I've been the director of the Family Services Division of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. As a social service professional and program planner, I strongly support the spirit and intent of HB 69. In a case of our immense size with its unique economic, geographic, and demographic environments, it makes a lot of sense to locally design and administer services such as those provided under temporary assistance programming. TCC's tribally administered temporary assistance program is currently in its seventh year of operation. While like all programs, there will always be room for improvement, the tribes of the interior are proud of the accomplishments they've collectively made to date in getting people from welfare to work. The report to the legislature prepared by the Division of Public Assistance indicates that is what the Native Family Assistance Program have been doing. They've been getting people to work in Alaska's urban areas, in their hub communities, and even in some of the most economically challenged rural areas of the state. The report and the outcomes achieved through this pilot program indicate that the state and the tribes are headed in the right direction, and HB 69 enables us to collectively and collaboratively stay what clearly appears to be a good course. Overall, HB 69 simply allows for the continuation of local program variations and innovations that makes sense to the people of diverse regions of the state. What works in Alabama doesn't necessarily work for Alaska, and the way they do it in Anchorage doesn't always make sense to the people from Angoon. The chances of achieving positive outcomes are greatly increased if the programs and services we provide are fairly, equitably, and locally administered and make sense to the people they serve. HB 69 is about common sense, get-to-work programming that fits. But it's about a lot more than that. HB 69 is about a sense of community, about local control, encouraging family and cultural values, marriage, fatherhood, work, self-sufficiency, and individual responsibility. It's about outcomes and creative ways to achieve them. It's about getting a bigger bang for the same buck and even about reducing the state's general fund expenditures. It's about the $33 million saved in state general funds in the past 5 years alone because of the Native Family Assistance Program, with the potential to save even more over the next 5 years and into the future. To us, HB 69 is about continuing one of the most successful collaborative partnerships between the states and the tribes to date. HB 69 is about work, and it's about working together. If there is one shortcoming of the bill, it would be that HB 69 includes no specific reference to child support enforcement programs that may be administered by a tribe. The landmark welfare reform legislation that enabled tribes to design and administer their own temporary assistance programs also enabled tribes to administer their own child support enforcement programming. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has already approved a plan for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Tribe to start up a tribally administered child support enforcement program, and tribes in the Tanana Chiefs Conference Service Area and the Association of Village Council Presidents are pursuing a similar course. We hope that the current mechanisms in place with the state's Child Support Enforcement Division to honor foreign orders will be sufficient to allow tribal child support enforcement programs adequate articulation with the state, and that the child support enforcement-related provisions in HB 69 will not be a detriment to the future development of these programs. Aside from this concern, TCC fully supports the overall intent of the bill. Our collective experience to date, we feel, indicates that we, the tribes and the state, are headed in the right direction. Madam Chairman and committee members, I hope you feel the same way and will support this bill. Thank you for your time and this opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. I do have a question for you. Has the child support enforcement program, is it working in other areas already?
Mm-hmm. There are, I believe, six original tribal child support enforcement programs throughout the country that were grandfathered in pending the final rule, which was recently published last spring.
In the lower 48?
Yes. All of the existing programs were in the lower 48. Some of them were quite successful, I might say. The Oklahoma program was able to collect over $10 million more than the state was from tribal areas.
Well, that sounds very interesting. We'll have to look into that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I guess that's all we have, so I will close public testimony. And what are the wishes of the committee? Representative Gardner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 69 with recommendations and four attached fiscal notes.
I object.
Representative Seaton objects?
Yes. I'd like to discuss a little bit of the last point that was made on the tribal support, and I'd like to get the state back up to testifying on, if we could.
Catherine, would you come back up here? And Representative Seaton has a question for you.
Hi, Catherine. Appreciate your testimony earlier, and I'm wondering, we just heard from, that was Tanana Chiefs, I believe,
yes,
from Don on incorporating tribal child support enforcement programs into this. Can you give me balance, or whether that's a good idea, or whether that is something that is necessary, or where we're at on that?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I actually am not an expert on the child support programs, nor the ones being run by the tribes in the lower 48. I can understand the reasoning associated with if it's good to be done in a community or if it's done culturally relevant, there perhaps are some merits in that. I did, however, have a chance to speak with the director of the, and I forget their acronym, but the Child Support Enforcement Division here in Alaska in the Department of Revenue. And this point had been raised, and we looked at the bill as not an appropriate vehicle to try to solve the question. If, in fact, the tribes in Alaska are going to move forward with tribal child support, that's going to take more than any little adjustment to this bill. This bill is specifically around the Native Family Assistance Program, the TANF program. The only reference to child support is that there is this relationship between child support and TANF that has to occur. If there will be future changes regarding tribal child support, I believe that's going to take a full discussion, and it's not necessarily allowed or stopped by this bill.
Representative Anderson?
And just to supplement what you stated to Representative Seaton, wouldn't it make it difficult in terms of the current system, and we have some problems that we're trying to work out through legislation and have been ongoing over the last 5 years, if we were to add that as an amendment to this bill? Not that that was a recommendation, but wouldn't it make it even more complicated and kind of get off the track of what we're trying to do on the work partnerships?
Representative Anderson, I couldn't have said it better.
Suddenly I'm an advocate for
yeah.
This guy's good. Turn the cameras off.
Well, and you know what, I'm actually thinking, too, that that might be something in the future. If we get what we're doing in place and see how it works, that might be a future thing. But and then by then we'll be able to see what's going on in the lower 48 and have time to study it and see how it could possibly work here.
Yes.
Representative Sisna.
Well, thank you. Just another note from someone who's been in the business world and survived is that when you take something on, you want to fully invest in it if you're going to succeed, and you don't overload yourself. You take on bite-sized pieces. So if we were to overload this new program, that's the kiss of death. That's not how you want success to be built.
Okay, Representative Seaton, do you maintain your objection?
No, I'll remember my objection.
Okay, thank you. Do I hear? Oh, so we have the motion. With no objection, then the motion passes. So thank you very much. And
he's so brilliant. The
record show that Representative McGuire has joined us. the committee will meet next Tuesday at 3, and on the agenda is House Bill 100 and House Bill 151, although I'm not sure, is House Bill 51, or is that the next week?
They've asked it to be delayed.
Okay, so I guess even though it's on the agenda, they're not sure they're ready for it, so we'll see about that. But House Bill 100 for sure. So without any more business for today, we are adjourned.